Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it is Tuesday, January 20th, Inauguration Day, and I think this is our third class session. We're going to move on to Chapter 2, which is Chemistry. And don't forget, another quiz on Thursday, and you get to drop two quizzes, but I don't know, do as best as you can on all of them. It's best to drop the last two as opposed to the first two. That puts more pressure on you. And typically when you have a lot of pressure on you, you don't do well, right? So it's best to do as well as you can right at the beginning of the class. So if you want to show me your weekly study plan sometime, that would be great. I don't know if anybody's doing that, but you might actually want to seriously do that because you probably can't just come to class and listen and do really well in this class. You probably still have to work with the material, even though it's outlined very nicely for you. All right, and so along those lines, if you don't know how to log into Blackboard yet, make sure this week that you know how to do that to find all your materials, right? All right, so let's get started with chemistry because chemistry molecules are the basic fundamental building blocks of life. So we have to know something about molecules in order to build life from something. All right, so chemistry is just the scientific study of the composition and structure of substances, plus the reactions that they undergo. All right, so we got to know something about what is a composition or what is a substance. There's different ways we can talk about substances. First, we can talk about matter. Matter is anything that occupies space. All right, so these tables are made out of matter. The projection system is made out of matter. Even the atmosphere, which is a gas, is made out of matter because there is something there that's occupying space. And what occupies space are elements, right? And an element is just matter composed of only one kind of atom. And so an element could be something like oxygen or nitrogen or hydrogen or carbon. These are elements. Right? And an atom is the smallest particle of an element, like oxygen is just going to have one atom. Right? A molecule is a particle of matter composed of more than one atom bound to each other by some kind of chemical bond. So for instance, you're probably familiar with a chemical formula of one kind of molecule already, and that's water. Well, how is water made? It's made of different elements. What are the two elements that make water up? Hydrogen and oxygen, and you know in what ratio or what proportion? H, how many to how many oxygen? H2O. Yeah, hydrogen, two hydrogen for every one oxygen. Right, so even before you took a science class, you probably know that H2O is the chemical formula for water, right? And the H's stand for hydrogen and the O stands for oxygen. Okay. All right, so there is a table in your book where you're going to have to know the English names for some elements and the chemical symbols. Some examples would be O for oxygen and C for carbon and for nitrogen. That's really easy, all right? But there are some tricky things that you have to know, and that is Na is the chemical symbol for sodium, all right? So even though there's no S in Na, the reason is because the elements were named in Greek, and the Greek word for sodium is natrium. And guess how you spell natrium? With an N-A, right? Yeah, with an N-A. So it's just abbreviated N-A, natrium. All right, and potassium is abbreviated with a K, not because of the English language, but because of the Greek language. And in Greek, potassium is kalium with a K. All right, so that's where that kind of comes from. So we got to memorize that. We're just trying to universalize the language of how we name these chemical elements from each other. And you can see all the chemical elements right on this table right here. This is what we call a periodic table. And some of these elements are very important biologically, and then some have no relevance whatsoever. So H is hydrogen, that's important because it helps make water. Okay. Here's sodium, here's potassium, these are important biologically. Calcium is important. Oh, where is calcium necessary in your body? and your bones, right? So the symbol for calcium is just Ca right here. Magnesium is important. That's Mg. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen are important. Phosphorus is important. There's a lot of phosphorus in your bones as well. That's P. Now, where it gets tricky is, for instance, iron. Another tricky one. Iron. Guess what the chemical symbol for iron is? It's not I. It is Fe right over here. You need a little bit of cobalt. That's Co. You need a little bit of copper and zinc. Copper is Cu. You might think that copper should be Co, but what's Co? Co is cobalt. All right. So there's a table that's either in your book or I have a slide right here that will show you what. There's probably about 10 or 15 chemical elements that you have to know the chemical symbol of. All right. So if iron is Fe, there's another important element biologically that is I, and it can't be iron. It's important for your thyroid gland, and that is iodine. Iodine is I. Where's iodine? Way over here. So that's most of the ones that are important. Oh, chlorine is important for us as well. That's capital C, little L. Okay, so there are some chemical symbols you have to know what the name is for the test. Okay, and so I'll give you a question, and then we're going to talk about the structure of an atom. The question is, what makes those elements different from each other? What makes oxygen different from carbon? What makes hydrogen different from sodium, for instance? And it's pretty easy, but I'm not going to tell you right away. It's really, really easy. But let's look at the structure of an atom first so that the definition is really easy to appreciate. Okay, so when we look at the structure of an atom, okay, we see that it is composed of other building blocks. There are things called protons, neutrons, and electrons. A proton is a relatively large particle, but it's charged. It's not neutral. It has an electrical charge, and it has an electrical charge of 1. Absolutely 1, not 1.00 anything. It's just absolutely 1, and it's a positive charge. There is another particle, which we call an electron, and it has a charge of 1 as well, but it's opposite to a proton. It's a minus 1. Right? So that if we put an electron and a proton together, what's the overall charge? It's going to be absolutely zero. It's going to be neutral because the charges are exactly equal to each other but opposite. And you know what? In terms of electrical charge, opposite charges attract. So positive charges attract negative charges, and like charges repel each other. So if we put two positive charges together, they're going to want to separate from each other. Doesn't matter if they're pluses or minuses. If we put two minus charges together, they're going to want to separate. Two plus charges together, they're going to want to separate. But if they're opposite, they attract. And then you have a particle that has no charge on it whatsoever, and that's what we call a neutron. So we have these three kinds of particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons. These make up atoms and all the different elements of the periodic table. So how should we think of an atom? We're going to use a solar system model of an atom. And so how would you maybe describe our solar system? Anybody take an astronomy class in here? What does our solar system kind of look like? What's in the center of our solar system? We've got the sun, right? That's shining all the light out. And what else makes up the solar system besides the sun? You got planets. And where do you find planets? Are they like inside the sun or where are they? They're way outside the sun, otherwise they'd burn up, right? They're in orbits, circling around the sun at some great distance from the sun, as a matter of fact. So let's use a solar system model to describe an atom. On the inside of an atom, you have, not the sun, but something we call the nucleus in the very center of the atom. And a nucleus has two kinds of particles in it. It can either have a proton or a neutron, never electrons. So here you see the nucleus of an atom, and here, what is my cursor on right here? What particle is my cursor on? A neutron, because it has no charge. And this one over here is a proton, because it's got a plus charge. So neutrons, protons, we see inside the nucleus. What particle are we left over with? What's left out? Electrons. Electrons aren't in the nucleus. Those are going to be in orbits outside the nucleus. And so we call these orbitals, or sometimes we call them shells. Either one or the other. Okay. And this is an okay description of how an atom really exists in nature. It will work for us just fine. So don't forget the two parts of an atom. You got the nucleus and you got orbitals. And where to put those three particles and what kind of charge those three particles have. Okay, so here is an electron. All right, so I was asking you, what makes these different elements different from each other? And what makes elements different from each other is just simply the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. So oxygen is different than nitrogen because it has a different number of protons inside the nucleus. And hydrogen is different than carbon because there's a different number of protons. All right, and this is the fun of the periodic table because the periodic table will tell us how many protons should be inside the nucleus to be a particular kind of element. So here is an element that has how many protons inside the nucleus?
Three.
Yes. So let's look at this periodic table over here, and we see that it's arranged by the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. Here's one. There's one proton inside the nucleus for, what is H? Hydrogen. And then over here, here is an element that has two. You see that two right there? I don't know if way in the back. All right, so for helium, how many protons are inside the nucleus?
Two.
And then we go back over here. Here is an element that has three. And you can see Li. You might not be able to read the name. That's not so important biologically. We use it pharmacologically sometimes for some people. This is lithium. So lithium is different than hydrogen because lithium has how many protons in the nucleus?
Three,
and hydrogen only has one. That's the difference in these different kinds of elements. And the periodic table tells you that. So I think maybe on a test, I might ask you how many protons are inside the nucleus for carbon. And I'm going to give you a periodic table so that you can show me that you know how to use the periodic table. So how many carbons are, how many protons are inside the nucleus of carbon? Okay. So what I'm going to do to make it even more fun, I think, for us, I'm going to erase the names, the English names. So you got to know what's the chemical symbol for carbon is?
C.
So you look for C. And how many protons are inside the nucleus?
Six.
And then you can answer that question. Okay. Not for all of these, but I have the list of elements you got to know. Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, the ones that we talked about here. You don't have to know weird things. What would be like a weird thing? A weird one? Oh, I should know where it is. Okay, well, like gold is not important. Okay. Osmium, uranium is not important, hopefully, okay, to us. But the biological ones, I'll let you know where they are. Okay. Okay. I like those. Let me see if I have the list right here. I might have the list in the slides, exactly. But that's a good place to start. There might be one on the next page. Okay. Okay. Furthermore, the number of protons inside the nucleus right here, we say determines what element it is. Because it's so important, we give that a name. Okay. That's what we call the atomic number. The atomic number is just the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. So what is the atomic number for sodium right here? Sodium is Na. What's the atomic number?
11.
But what does that mean? What does that 11 mean?
It's
got 11 protons inside the nucleus. So atomic number are the number of protons inside the nucleus. Okay. So, you know what? This chapter 2 might be the most difficult chapter in the book because none of you have ever seen a sodium atom before or a molecule. This is probably the most abstract part of the class, but I don't think it's too difficult if you look at that information a couple times, right? Atomic number, just the number of protons inside the nucleus. Okay. So I think I have that in your notes right here. You got the nucleus only contains protons and neutrons, orbitals only electrons. Okay, let's move on to another slide right here. How do I go to the next one? Okay, so here is, I could do this with my transparencies, but I can't do it with a slide right here. What's the name of an element that has one proton inside the nucleus?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, and you can see it on the periodic table. What is the name of the element that has two protons inside the nucleus?
Helium.
All right. And then lithium, of course, all right, has got three. Don't forget the number of protons inside the nucleus is called the atomic number. All right. Okay. Well, that's important, okay, because the number of protons inside the nucleus determines how many electrons an element gets. All right, so in order to be neutral, how many electrons does hydrogen, how many electrons should hydrogen have to be neutral?
One.
Yeah, because what is the relative difference between a proton and electron? Yeah, they're exactly the same charge, just opposite each other. So when they combine, it produces something that's neutral. Right? Okay. So on the screen right here, I've got something that has 11 protons inside the nucleus. On the periodic table, what is that element? What element has an atomic number of 11? You got it right here, sodium. Okay? Okay, there's a sodium. Okay, so in order for sodium to be neutral, how many electrons should it have?
11.
That's right. All right, so where do these electrons go? Do they go inside the nucleus or where? They go outside the nucleus in orbitals, and this is how electrons are added to, no, this is how electrons are added to atoms, okay? They can't all go into one orbital. They have to go into many orbitals or shells. So on this atom, I see 1, 2, 3 orbitals or shells, and here are the rules for adding electrons. The first shell or first orbital only has 1 or 2 electrons, no more. All right, so we've got to add some more electrons to this atom right here. Can't go in the first orbital, so where do they go? Into the second orbital. And when we look at the second orbital, we see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And 8 is the maximum for the second orbital. So how many electrons is that so far? 2 in the first, 8 in the second, so 2 plus 8, that's 10. But sodium has how many electrons?
11,
so there's one left over. Where does that one go? Into the third orbital, right? It has to go in the third one. Oh, and here I see that nice lonely electron all by itself in the third orbital, okay? And I think you can kind of see the structure of these shells right here symbolized in the periodic table, because in the first row, so you don't have to remember your rules, it tells you on the periodic table here. In the first shell, how many electrons are there?
Two.
1, 2. So in the first row of the periodic table, we only place 2 elements. Now in the next shell, how many electrons go in the next shell?
8.
So if we go to the second row, how many elements are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Good, I remembered that correctly. Okay, and then the next shell has got how many?
8
again. And that's as far as we're going to go in this class. So you can see that there's a lot of structure in the periodic table. It resembles how atoms are put together in terms of their orbitals, right? So you don't have to necessarily remember 2, 8, and 8. You can just look at the periodic table to remind yourself of that. Okay. All right, so what's the atomic number for sodium?
11.
That's just the number of protons. Okay. Now here's something else about how atoms like to exist in nature. Of course, they like to be neutral. They like to have the same number of electrons and protons in an atom so that it can be neutral. But there is something else that is overriding that neutrality factor, and that is that the outermost shell, all right, should have 8 electrons in it. But here we have the outer shell that has 1 electron. So what does sodium really want to do? It wants to sacrifice its electrical neutrality and get rid of this electron to somebody else. Because when it gets rid of this electron, then the outer shell has 8, right? 8 electrons, it's completely filled up. And then sodium will become very stable as a result of that. Right? So all atoms like to have a full complement of electrons in the outermost shell to be stable. But I tell you what, when that happens, what's the overall charge? If sodium gets rid of this one electron, what's the overall charge of this atom now? Okay. If it gets rid of an electron, It's missing a minus charge, so the overall charge now becomes positive 1. Okay? All right, so that exists in nature very readily. Compounds that have an electrical charge on them, because maybe they get rid of these electrons or accept electrons. In order for sodium to get rid of this electron right here, it's got to find another molecule that wants to accept it. Right? It just can't throw it off on the floor someplace. It's got to go someplace to another atom. Right? And sodium becomes a positive charge, and whoever accepts this electron becomes one negative. So we can find molecules or atoms that have a charge on them, and we give that a special name. Those compounds are what we call ions. So ions are compounds or atoms that have an electrical charge on them. So sodium becomes an ion. So where do I have that in your notes? All right. Ah, I don't have it right here. I should have it right here. All right. So an ion is an atom or molecule with a charge. And it goes by another name too. We call that an electrolyte. So that electro comes from the term that it has this electrical charge. And these electrolytes are very important in your body. And as a matter of fact, we measure them in people's blood all the time. Maybe somebody's in the emergency room and they're having trouble. The person has trouble adjusting sodium levels inside their body or magnesium levels, and their body gets out of whack, and a physician is going to say, "We need some lights on this patient right away." So if you're working in that emergency room and somebody gives you an order to get some lights on this patient right away, guess what that means? Should you go find a lamp and shine some lights on the patient? Okay, that's what it sounds like. But what you're being ordered to do is to get some electrolyte concentrations to find out what the chloride level is, or magnesium level, or sodium level of these different ions or electrolytes are inside somebody, because that could be producing a disease state. Okay. Valence is a term, right, that talks about the outermost shell right here is what we call the valence shell. So these are what we call valence electrons, right, the outermost shell. And sometimes when an atom has a charge on it, like when sodium gets rid of this electron, it has a plus one charge. We then call that an ion. That's what we would call a monovalent ion, because it has one plus. Okay, there are other kinds of ions that might have two pluses on them. We don't want to call those monovalent ions. We want to call those bivalent or divalent, meaning two. And some ions might have three charges on them, three plus charges. Guess what we would call that ion? That would be a trivalent ion, right? Okay, so monovalent for one, bivalent for two, trivalent for three. Okay. All right, let's look at the next slide right here. Okay, so we said that chemistry is the result of these electrons that are in the shells around the atom. And as a matter of fact, chemistry is the result of interactions with the outermost shells. And that outermost shell is what we call the valence shell. So chemistry is the result of activity of these valence electrons. So in this particular case, we said that sodium wants to get rid of this one electron in its outer shell to become stable, to become an ion. So there has to be a molecule that wants to accept this electron. All right, so sodium is going to look over the whole universe to find another atom that wants to accept an electron. And it just so happens that there's plenty around. And the name of the element that wants to accept an electron is chlorine. Let's look at the periodic table. Chlorine, the abbreviation for chlorine is Cl. What's the atomic number for Cl using the periodic table here? Where's Cl? 17. That's the atomic number, or number of protons inside the nucleus. Let's fill up its shells with electrons. So how many electrons do we get to play with? We get 17, because it has 17 protons. All right, so in the first shell, how many electrons go in there? Yeah, if you look at the periodic table, the first row, you see two. All right, and then we got 8 in the next shell. So 2 plus 8, that's 10. So we got how many left over?
7.
7. So we get to put 7 in the last shell or the valence shell. Here's 7. But how many should there be to become stable?
8.
So here's chlorine, willing to accept an electron from somebody because then its valence shell is completely filled with electrons. Who is it going
to
handshake with? Okay, it's going
to
handshake with sodium because sodium wants to get rid of one, chlorine wants to accept one, and that reaction happens very easily. But when that happens, don't forget, sodium has a leftover positive charge because it's missing an electron, chlorine because it's gained an electron, now has one more electron compared to a proton, so it has a minus charge on it. And what can you tell me about these opposite charges? They attract each other. So sodium and chloride attract each other because they have opposite charges. That's what we call an ionic bond. An ionic bond because an ionic bond forms between two atoms, like sodium and chloride, because they're ions. They're both monovalent ions. Okay. Now, when you sodium chloride is just table salt. The strength of an ionic bond is not very strong because, you probably know this, when you take sodium chloride and you put it in water or something, what happens to it? Does it just sink to the bottom as a crystal? It dissolves and becomes a part of the water solution. So the ionic bond that's holding sodium and chloride together is so weak, just by putting it in water breaks that bond and then it dissolves right into the water. So ionic bonds are relatively weak bonds that break apart pretty easily. All right, even if you put it in water. Okay, so I think that's all I want to say about ionic bonds. Okay, one other thing that I want to talk about. So ions can have different kinds of charges, not just the number 1, 2, 3, but they can either be plus charges or minus charges. And so we have different names for the sign of those charges. If it is a negatively charged ion, we call it an anion. If it's a positively charged ion, we call it a cation. So a good question would be, sodium has, just tell me, is it positive or negative? Sodium is positive. So is it a cation or an anion? It's a cation. And it has one charge, so it is a monovalent, for one charge, cation. So with that terminology, we can completely describe all these different ions by their charge and also the magnitude of the charge. And I had an organic chemistry teacher one time tell me the difference between a cation and an anion, and I've never forgotten this. Okay. Actually, I could make it a little bit happier. Okay, so what does that look like? That's a cat right there. All right, so cations are positive. Okay, you might have to live with that for the rest of your life. I'm sorry. But at least you won't forget. Okay? Okay. So that's the difference between cation and anion, and they can have different valencies depending on how their outer shell is constructed with those electrons. Okay, so chemical bonds. The first one we talked about is ionic bond. All right, that's relatively weak. We say intermediate strength. Yeah. Oh, you know, I don't talk much about neutrons inside the nucleus of an atom, but since you asked, I'll go back really quickly. It makes a difference sometimes, maybe for the following reason. So here we see the nucleus of this lithium right here. We've got these three protons right there. Now, what did we say about like charges? Do they attract or repel each other? Like those protons all have a positive charge. Do those positive charges all attract or they repel? They'll repel each other. But we stick them all inside one nucleus like that. How do we get all those positive charges that don't like to be together inside the nucleus? That's where the job of a neutron comes in. So the neutron sort of acts like a glue that adds, that glues protons together so the nucleus doesn't fly apart because all those protons don't want to be in there. All right, so that's really more the realm of a physics class or a nuclear chemistry class. so we're not going to talk about that. But you know what? There are some atoms that magically fly apart and spit out energy and particles. Those are called radioactive particles, where the nucleus actually breaks apart. And those high-energy particles can be used for imaging. We can shoot them through people to make an image of their insides. Or because they're high energy, we can kill certain tissues, for instance. What kind of tissue might you want to kill that's inside your body? Yeah, like cancer, right? So for killing tumors and things like that, we can get atoms that have this tendency to fly apart. When they fly apart, if we direct them into somebody's body, we can kill certain things inside your body that shouldn't be there, right? So it depends on the ratio of protons to neutrons to figure out if it's going to be stable or not, if it's going to break apart. Okay, so that's why those neutrons are in there, just to make sure all those protons stick together. Yeah.
So sodium is already positive, or is positive because it's giving away an electron?
It's positive because it's donating an electron to another atom someplace.
So whatever atom receives electrons, it becomes negative?
It becomes an ion too, but in this case it's going to be negative. Sodium becomes positive, and whatever accepts that electron becomes negative. Yeah.
Is the number of protons at all related to density of that element? Like, for example, gold, is it so heavy? Does that have a lot of protons?
It also has to do with how the shells are formed. Not so much these first couple shells that we talked about, but as you can see, as we get further and further down in atomic number, we get some additional shells, different orbitals, and that's what helps determine some other properties of those elements. Okay, how closely packed together they can be. Yeah. Okay. So ionic bond, intermediate in strength. If you were just trying to just simply describe an ionic bond in terms of electrons, how would you describe an ionic bond? What's happening to those electrons, or that maybe one electron? One atom donates an electron, and another atom accepts an electron, right? So an ionic bond, the key ways to think about ionic bond is donating and accepting of electrons. Electrons actually go from one atom to another. That will make more sense when we talk about another kind of bond, and that is going to be the covalent bond. Where's the covalent bond? The covalent bond is the strongest. Oh, well, look at this definition, right? Ionic bond, one atom loses an electron, and another accepts or gains that electron, thus forming ions, right? Or atoms with some kind of electrical charge on them. All right, a covalent bond is the strongest. Let's see what we got in terms of slides for covalent bonds. We looked at that one. We looked at that one. It's ion. Okay. So what element is this that has one proton inside the nucleus?
Hydrogen.
Atomic number is? One. Right? You see that on the periodic table. Okay. Now, in order for this hydrogen atom to be stable, how many electrons should there be in this valence shell? There should be two, but it's only got one. So, in order for this atom here to be satisfied, we need to give it another electron. And you know what? Something special can happen if two hydrogen atoms bump into each other. This atom can share this electron, and the one on the left-hand side can share this one. Right, so this is going to form a molecule of two hydrogen atoms, and these electrons sometimes are over here, and then sometimes they're over here. These two atoms are going to share an electron, and since they're sharing, this atom feels as if it has two, and this one over here feels as if it has two as well. All right, so this is the basis of a covalent bond. It's not donating and accepting of electrons. How would you talk about this one? Sharing of electrons forms covalent bonds, and covalent bonds are the strongest kind of bonds. Okay. Okay, so these electrons can go anywhere. Now, what about the overall charge of this molecule? Does the charge change when a covalent bond is formed? No. Right? Because there's still two protons and two electrons. You add those together, you get zero. No ions are formed. All right, so only with ionic bonds. So don't forget, ionic bonds you described as donating and accepting of electrons. Covalent bonds are sharing of electrons. But you have to have a little bit of orbital theory to kind of see that a little bit, right? You should be able to draw that out. Okay. Well, oops, I can't use a scroller. I got to go to the next one right here. Okay. Well, how about, so here is a hydrogen molecule. Molecule has just two atoms in it. How about, you guys feel like you could build a water molecule? Let's see if we could build a water molecule using this orbital theory. All right, so what electrons, again, allow for chemical bonds to form? What are the electrons? The ones in the outermost shell, right? We call those valence electrons. And so let's start with the atom that's right in the middle of a water molecule. You only got one of. Which atom is that? Oxygen. How many, what's the atomic number for oxygen? Okay, look at the periodic table. Oxygen is O, and then you look for the atomic number, the number in the side. Okay, it's 8. So here is oxygen with 8. Here is the first shell. How many electrons? Okay, let's put one here and one here. How many are left over? 6. Can I put them here? I got to go to the next higher shell, so there are 6. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, and let's put them 5, 6. How did I do? Perfect. Okay, got 6. How many does oxygen want to place in this outer shell to become stable? 2 more, right? It wants to have 8 in there. So it's going to look for 2 electrons someplace. Where can it get it from? How about hydrogen? Hydrogen has how many electrons in its shell? It's got 1. 1 proton, and it's got 1 shell. So here is 1 electron. And over here, we can put another proton. How many electrons in this shell? 1. So these right here are shared. These right here are shared. So we've got hydrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, or what? Hydrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, H2O. And these are nice covalent bonds that are relatively strong. Okay, so you could build a lot of molecules now just by filling in electrons into these different shells. But that's how water is made, by knowing atomic number and your rules for using electrons. Okay. Okay, now here is something. What about the overall charge on this water molecule? How many protons do we have in this water molecule? 8, 9, 10. How many electrons in this water molecule? 8, 9, 10. 10 electrons, 10 protons. What's the overall charge? It's neutral. So water has no charge on it. It's just a neutral molecule. But it's a very interesting molecule because it tricks you to think that it has no charge on it. Okay? Water is what we call a polar molecule for the following reason. What's something that's polar? Are you polar? Is the human body polar? Well, you have an anterior side and a posterior side. You have 2 different sides, so in that sense you're polar. Your superior side from your inferior side is a lot different looking, so you're polar in that sense as well. So the human body is polar. If you look at the human body from different perspectives, it looks differently, right? What about the Earth? The Earth is a sphere, but is the Earth polar? Okay, it's polar not for what you can see, but because of the magnetic field. Okay, there's a north pole and a south pole. The Earth is really a magnet with 2 opposite poles. Depending on how you look at the Earth, it looks different in terms of magnetism. All right. Well, the water molecule is a little bit interesting because it's polar. Depending on how you look at it, it looks differently. And that's because this oxygen atom right here likes to pull these electrons into the nucleus, and these electrons into the nucleus. All right, so if you're going to walk up on one water molecule from over here, from this direction, does it look like it has a little charge on it? Overall, you know it's neutral, but if you walk up from this side, what does it look like? You see that proton inside the nucleus right here. So this side of a water molecule looks what? A little positive. And if you walk up on a water molecule from over here, it looks a little positive. But if you walk up on a water molecule from right here, guess what it looks like? A little negative. Now, this positive and this positive and that negative cancel out. Overall, it's neutral. But if you get really close to this water molecule, there are regions that look positive, there are regions that look negative. Therefore, we say the water molecule is polar because of these different regions on it. And we're not going to describe exactly why that is, but just take it for granted that that's how it is, because water is polar. Okay. Okay. So let's put, so I'm going to erase this right now, because we don't need to see all those orbitals in there. Let's draw just a couple water molecules. I'll leave the polar up here. So we've got oxygen and hydrogen, oxygen and hydrogen. What end, in terms of electrical properties, what end of the molecule is this, positive or negative, down by the oxygen? This is going to be a little bit negative, and this is going to be a little bit positive and a little bit positive here. Now let's put in this beaker, instead of one water molecule, another water molecule. How are these two water molecules going to exist next to each other? If we put a second water molecule in, can it exist like this? Right? Because this oxygen here is going to be a little bit negative. Will these water molecules like to touch each other like that? No, because same charges repel each other. Opposite charges attract. So if we put a second water molecule in this beaker, how does it have to be? Like this. Right? Just like that. And then if we put another water molecule in, how's it going to go? Right? It's going to arrange itself just like this. Or maybe, you know, if we put another one here, it's going to look like that. So this positive charge and that negative charge will attract each other. This will attract each other. So water molecules are attracted to each other. Water is actually very sticky. Water is really like a glue. You might think that it's very slippery, but it forms these very kinds of weak bonds. See the hydrogen to this oxygen right here? Because this is positive and this is negative. We call these hydrogen bonds. And hydrogen bonds are the weakest kinds of bonds between molecules. They're very, very weak. Because if there is a pond or a river or something and you step on that water, can those bonds hold you up? What's going to happen to you? You're going to go kaplunk right in there. Those hydrogen bonds are weak and just your weight will separate them. But if you're a very light animal, guess what can happen? You've seen some animals walk right on the surface of water because they're so light. They're not heavy enough to break these hydrogen bonds apart like water spiders and different kinds of insects and things like that. The water molecules like to stick together because of these hydrogen bonds. And your body uses hydrogen bonds sometimes. For instance, if there's a molecule in your body that maybe should be assembled, but you want to take it apart later and then put it back together, and then take it apart again and then put it back together, what kind of bond would you like to use to put these molecules together so that you can take them apart again and then put them back together again? A strong bond or a weak bond? A weak bond, like a hydrogen bond. Okay, if your body puts something together and it wants it to stay put together, okay, what kind of bond do you think your body would like to use? A strong one? And give me an example. Give me the name of the strongest bond. Covalent bond. Yeah, glue, like Gorilla Glue, right? Covalent bond. Okay. All right, so here are hydrogen bonds. That's the weakest kind of bond. All right, so here are the three kinds. Strongest is covalent. Intermediate is ionic. Hydrogen is the weakest. Okay. All right, so here you can see a hydrogen bond between the oxygen and the hydrogen right here. And that's because, it all develops because this oxygen, the center part of water, likes to hoard the electrons. It's very greedy in terms of electrons. It likes to pull electrons toward the nucleus of the oxygen atom. Okay, and that would be a really nice physical chemistry class to see why that happens. But that's not too important in here, okay? Okay. So let's talk about chemical reactions that have to do with those valence electrons. This is how we talk about chemical reactions. Well, a chemical reaction is just a process by which atoms or molecules interact to form or break chemical bonds. And so this is how we would write a reaction on a piece of paper. So we have four different molecules right here. We got molecule A and B, and we got molecule C and D. Okay, these are different arrangements of molecules. They could have different elements in them. And we see that we can take molecule A and B, put them together, and they might form two different kinds of compounds, C and D. As we go read this equation from left to right, the things that we have on the left-hand side of the equation are what we call reactants, and the things we see on the right-hand side of the equation, these are what we call products. Right? So in this particular case, what are the products? C and D. And the reactants are A and B. Right? So I suppose I could make that a question on the test. Right? So don't forget that one. Okay. Let me take a look. I know that seems really simple, but don't forget it. Oh, here's how you build like an oxygen molecule and a water molecule based on the orbital theory that we looked at. That's fun to look at. Okay. All right, so these are chemical reactions. A good example of a biological reaction. Okay, we got three different molecules right here. We got something called adenosine diphosphate. What does that term di mean? It means two, and phosphate means it has two phosphates on it. And adenosine triphosphate is an adenosine molecule with three phosphates on it. All right, and there is another compound called inorganic phosphate. Sometimes I just symbolize that P sub I, standing for inorganic phosphate. And it has this chemical symbol right here, phosphate with four oxygens around it. That's what that PO4 stands for, and it's the same thing for inorganic phosphate. So inorganic phosphate has how many phosphates?
One.
And adenosine diphosphate has two. And if we put inorganic phosphate and adenosine diphosphate together, how many phosphates do we have now all in one molecule? We've got three, which is what we call adenosine, ATP or adenosine triphosphate. So this is how your body makes ATP. ATP is the gasoline that is in your body that runs all the energy, that keeps you alive. ATP is the energy molecule inside your body, like the molecule gasoline is in your car. So if your body runs out of ATP, what happens to you? You're dead, yes, unfortunately. And death is what? Irreversible. It can't get you back to life again after that when your body runs out of ATP. So here is an important relationship, how your body makes ATP. It takes ADP, which has two phosphates. It takes inorganic phosphate that has one, along with some energy that we get from the foods that we eat. And your body makes ATP. And in particular, there's an organelle inside of a cell that's responsible for making ATP. We're going to get to that in the next chapter, but somebody might know already. Does anybody know what the little organelle inside a cell is called that makes ATP? It's the whole job of this organelle. It's called a mitochondria. I'll mention it again. The mitochondria makes ATP. And then things that require energy will break ATP down back into ADP and inorganic phosphate, releasing that energy, for instance, like for muscle contraction that requires energy. In order for your muscles to contract, you need ATP inside those cells. So the first reaction to make ATP, so ADP and inorganic phosphate right here are what we call what? Reactants or products? Reactants. And it's going to form a product called ATP. And other parts of your body that are going to use ATP, we can see the reverse of that reaction. In this particular case, ATP is a product. Reactants. And the products are going to be ADP and inorganic phosphate. And in so doing, it's going to release that energy that can be used for another kind of process, like muscle contraction, or to think a thought, or something of that nature. All right, so that's how we talk about chemistry in terms of these reactions right here. Okay, another important topic in this class has to do with acids and bases. Okay, acids and bases. So let's define what an acid and a base is. Okay, an acid is a compound that is a proton donor. For instance, like hydrochloric acid. So what the heck is, what's a proton? So I'm going to draw on the board an element, and you got to tell me what this element is. Inside the nucleus, there's this, and in the orbital, there is this. What element is that?
Hydrogen.
Because what's the atomic number?
One,
and you see it on the periodic table. So that's the hydrogen atom. It's got one proton, one electron. What do we call this thing? Let's take away that electron. Now what's that? What is that? That's a proton. Perfect. That's a proton. Okay, all by itself. It's a proton all by itself. And what can you tell me about a molecule or an atom that has a charge on it? What's the charge on this one?
Plus one.
It's a monovalent what? It's a monovalent cation. Okay, monovalent cation. So a proton is a monovalent cation. So because it's an ion and it's from the hydrogen atom, sometimes we call this the hydrogen ion. Hydrogen ion. Is it an ion? Yeah, because it's a monovalent cation. It's an ion. It has a charge. So these two terms are used interchangeably. Proton and hydrogen ion are exactly the same thing. It's just a hydrogen atom that is missing its electron. That's a hydrogen ion. Okay. Very important because these hydrogen ions are very reactive. They change the chemistry inside our bodies. All right, so an acid is a compound that is a proton donor, which means what? When you put it in water, it produces these things, which is a good example would be hydrochloric acid. When we put it in water, it becomes hydrogen plus a chloride anion. And since when we put hydrochloric acid in water, it produces a lot of these things, we call that an acid, right? Because it's just a proton. It's donating protons to that water solution. Okay. And as a matter of fact, hydrochloric acid is a strong acid because when we put it in water, it completely dissolves. It completely dissociates. So you won't find hydrogen and chloride together anywhere in there. It completely dissociates. Other kinds of acids, only part of them break apart. For hydrochloric acid, everything breaks apart. Okay. Don't forget, hydrogen, H plus, is called a hydrogen ion or a proton, the same thing. A base, on the other hand, is a compound that is a proton acceptor when we put it in water. A good example of that would be sodium hydroxide. When we put sodium hydroxide in water, it breaks apart into sodium ions and hydroxide anions. And what can this OH do when it's in water? If you have an OH that's in water, it can combine with, what's this thing called?
Proton.
A proton or a hydrogen ion. And what's that going to produce?
Water.
That's going to produce water, H2O. Okay, so bases and acids will neutralize each other and form what?
Water.
Okay. So a base is something that produces these guys, an acid is something that produces these. If we put acids and bases together, it's going to form water. And that changes the chemistry of our body quite a bit. So OH is sometimes called a hydroxide ion. Usually we don't have to say anion, but it's an anion. Okay. Say what? Anion is a negative. Cation is positive. Yeah, so proton is a cation. Hydroxide is an anion.
Okay?
Okay. And they neutralize each other. All right, so we want to become familiar with how acidic our bodies are. And there is a number that we use to describe how acidic a solution is. Okay, and that comes from the pH scale. So a pH scale is a number, and it's a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. So pH is going to measure, when I put brackets around this thing right here, that means concentration of. So as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, does it become more basic or more acidic? It becomes more acidic. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, it becomes more acidic. As the hydrogen ion concentration goes down, it becomes more basic. Okay? And the pH scale is something that we use to describe the acidity or the basic nature of a solution. Okay? And the pH scale goes from 0 to 14. That's all pH can be. It can't be 15 or 20 or, you know, 1,000 or something like that. Only 0 to 14, so it's pretty easy. All right, but now here's something that's a little bit funny. Acidic ranges from 0 to 7 or 6.99. And what's the number right smack in the middle of 0 to 14? 7. Okay, and that's neutral. So pH 7 is absolutely neutral. What does that mean? When something is neutral, the concentration of hydrogen ion is exactly equal to the concentration of hydroxide ions, so there's not more of one or the other. We call it neutral, and that's pH 7. Right? And as the pH number increases from 7 to 14, it becomes basic. All right, so this is kind of a little bit funny. So let's see if we can follow my thinking on this. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the acidity? It increases. But what about the pH number? The pH number, as something becomes more acidic, actually goes down. We call that inversely related to each other. And you'll get familiar with that. We use that all the time. As the pH number goes down, it becomes more acidic. So that's really confusing the first couple of times you look at it as a new student. Usually as the number goes down, you think, oh, well, the acidity is decreasing. But that's not true for the pH number. I'd have to show you the equation that we use to calculate pH, but I don't think we need to do that. Okay? It's just inversely related to each other. So a good way for me to test you, all right, is to draw some examples on the board. Let me put three beakers on the board. Right, and so here's one right here in the middle. Okay, and you know what? I'm not going to put pH 7 in the middle. I'll put it someplace else. Okay, so for some of these, you should be able to tell me what the pH is. Others, you might only be able to tell me if it's acidic or basic. Okay. Okay. So this one right here, this first beaker, is this neutral or is it acidic or basic? So again, think of what's the basis of acidity. It's just the amount of hydrogen ions or protons in solution. And in this solution, are there more hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions?
Hydrogen.
More hydrogen ions. So that means it is acidic. All right, so here is, this is acidic. What about here? Okay, you said basic. I like it. Why did you say basic? Has more hydroxide ions in there. So we say basic. And what about this one here? Did I draw it right? Good. This is neutral. Why did you say neutral? Hydrogen and hydroxide ions are exactly equal amounts. Okay? So if they're exactly equal amounts, what's the pH number? It's got to be pH 7. Okay? And if it's basic, what's the pH number? Yeah? Oops. Isn't that quite a 7? 7.1 to 14. The pH number goes up. Okay, and this one, high hydrogen ion concentration, what's the pH number? 0 to 6.99. So don't forget, as the acidity goes up, the pH number goes down, so you might want to think of that picture, yeah, during a test or something. How do you get those numbers? Okay. Well, we always look at the hydrogen ion concentration, okay? And the hydrogen ion concentration, we give it in terms of molarity. All right, so if we have a hydrogen ion concentration of 0.01 moles per liter, that's the same thing as 1 times 10 to the minus 1, right? We just have to move that decimal place over one time. And if it's 0.01, it's 1 times 10 to the minus 2, because you got to move the decimal point over two times. So you see this number, I tell you what's a bigger number, 0.1 or 0.01? 0.1 is a lot bigger, 10 times bigger than this one. What's 10 times smaller than this? 0.001, which is what? 1 times 10 to the minus 3. Okay, and if this is equal to the hydrogen ion concentration in terms of molarity, this is a small number, this is even smaller, this is even smaller. But what about this number? It is what? It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the hydrogen ion concentration decreases. So the pH is really a measure of this exponent right here, but we take the minus sign off. All right, so if we have a hydrogen ion concentration, which is really, really, really weak, 0.001, or 1 times 10 to the minus 3, what's the pH of that? The pH for this one right here is going to be equal to 3. The pH of this one is going to be equal to 2, and here's the pH equal to 1. So the pH of 3 is not as acidic as the pH of 2, not as acidic as the pH of 1 because of this exponent right here. Okay? And you really want to see the equation? pH is equal to the log, okay, base 10, of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. So you can see the pH is inversely related because the hydrogen ion concentration is in the denominator. It's not in the numerator. If it was in the numerator, it would be directly related, and it would work differently. But because the hydrogen ion concentration is in the denominator right here, that means as this number gets bigger, this number here gets smaller. If it was in the numerator, as this number gets bigger, so would this one. But it's not. It's in the denominator. Okay. So that gives you maybe a little hint where that pH number comes from. Okay, because of the equation. Now, what's the pH inside your body? What would you guess it's going to be close to? 0, 7, or 14?
7.
It should be close to 7. It's not exactly 7. The pH in your body is going to be 3.5, but it's probably in a little bit of a range. 7.4, maybe somebody would say. That would be fine with me. So what are we? Are we a little bit basic or acidic? We're a little bit basic, because basic is from 7 to 14. Acidic means from 0 to 7, so we're a little bit basic. Now, if our body changed from 7.35 to 7.1 very quickly, does that look like a big change to you in terms of that number? That looks like a pretty small change to me, but you know what? If that were to change inside your body in a matter of minutes, I'm sure it would be fatal. Not a very big change. And we eat things that are very basic and acidic all the time. What's your favorite acidic kind of food or drink? Yeah, for instance, like Coca-Cola. It has a pH of about 1, which means what? Far away from 7, that's extremely acidic. So if we drink all that acid, you think that that would drag this pH number down in our bodies, you know, like a pH 4 or 2 or 5 or something, and that would be fatal for sure. How come we don't die when we drink Coca-Cola? Because our bodies have other kinds of compounds that are pretty cool. They're called buffers. And buffers prevent a change in pH when you pour an acid into it or a base. So our bodies have buffers that prevent a change in pH when we eat an acid. Or if our body produces acid, our pH doesn't change. Right, so here's a good definition of a buffer. A compound that resists changes in pH when either an acid or a base is added to a solution. And guess what we are? We're a solution. Okay, we're just a bag of water with a bunch of chemicals dissolved in it. Right, so if we pour an acid in there, our pH would change, but inside our body, There are buffers, and we might look at some buffers later on in the class. There's phosphate buffers and bicarbonate buffers that prevent the change of pH inside our body, because otherwise we couldn't function at all. All right, so let's see what you have for pictures in your text. So here's a nice kind of graphic of the pH scale. The red represents the concentration of hydrogen ions just by the area of the square. It's sort of like a square, right? It's chopped off at one side, but this is like a square. This is the biggest square. This shows what? The highest amount of hydrogen ions, which means what? This is the most acidic, which means it is the lowest pH. Right, the blue represents the concentration of hydroxide ions, and as we go from 0 to 14, what happens to the concentration of hydroxide ions? It increases, it becomes more basic, right? Okay, so neutral, distilled water, human blood is about 7.4, egg whites are about at 8, okay? Milk of magnesia, which we take for an overly acidic stomach or upset stomach, is pretty basic. It's 10.5, but what can you tell me about acids and bases? They, if you add them together, they neutralize each other. So when you drink milk of magnesia, that neutralizes the acid that's in your stomach. It makes your stomach feel a little bit better, right? Okay, ammonia, very basic. Can you see some of these acidic things? Cabbage, 5.3. Tomato juice is pretty acidic. Apple juice, what's this? Oh, gastric juice. Well, that's the stuff that gets secreted into your stomach from your body to digest food. That's very acidic too. That's why if you ever have any reflux at night or something, it like burns your throat or your mouth, right? Because it's very acidic in there. Okay. So don't forget, as the pH number goes down, the hydrogen concentration increases. And as the pH number goes up, the hydrogen ion concentration decreases, or you could say the hydroxide concentration increases. Okay, so that's a little bit tricky of a concept, but that's a nice little thing for you to look at. Okay, the next topic in chemistry are organic molecules. Okay, and there are four kinds of organic molecules that make up most of the organic molecules inside your body. So let's define what an organic molecule is first.
Any compound
that has carbon atoms? That's really close. That's really close. Do I have that in my notes?
Yeah.
Okay. But you need to modify your notes because there's a better answer. There's even a little bit better answer. All right. What is this element? C is carbon. What is this element? Hydrogen. In order to be an organic compound, it's got to have both. So my notes are a little deficient. I should go back and correct my notes. Okay? Organic has got to have at least one of these and one of these that are bound together by a covalent bond. What's the strength of a covalent bond again?
Sharing
of electrons. Strong bond. Okay? So for instance, there are some molecules that are very important in your body, namely carbon dioxide. We breathe this out. We produce carbon dioxide through our metabolism. Very important biological molecule. The question is that an organic molecule? Okay, is it organic? What's the definition of organic? Carbon plus hydrogen. Well, where do you see that hydrogen in there? It doesn't have one. Okay, so is that an organic molecule? No, but is it important biologically? Absolutely. What about H2O? Is that organic? Is that important for you? Absolutely. So you have inorganic molecules like CO2 and water and organic molecules, right? So let's look at some of these more organic molecules that are inside your body. What do they got to have? Carbon and hydrogen with some covalent bond between them. And there are four major kinds of these organic molecules. You got carbohydrates. That's one. Lipids are another. Proteins are third. And the fourth, what is that? I got two, okay. I don't know what happened there. Okay, that should just be a continuation of proteins. The fourth one, two number threes. Oh, okay, I guess it sort of makes sense. And the fourth kind are nucleic acids. Okay, so with these four classes of organic compounds. I want you to know what the building blocks are for each one of these. Building block, a very important concept, right? So don't forget, chemistry is the building block of cells. So, and I want you to know the building blocks of these different compounds. Okay, let's talk about carbohydrates first. So let me see what I got in terms of pictures. All right, so here is an example of a glucose molecule. This C stands for carbon. This O stands for? And H is for? Hydrogen. All right, and on this carbon atom right here, we see it is bound to this hydrogen. So is this an organic compound? Yeah, because it's got carbon and hydrogen. All right, and you can see that glucose has this long chain of carbons that acts as a backbone to form this molecule. And on every carbon atom, what is bound to every carbon atom? How many hydrogens? How many hydrogens are bound to this carbon right here? Oh, I see one. Ah, but don't forget about this. I mean this one too. So how many hydrogens are bound? I see two by this oxygen right here. And how many oxygens? One. So what do we call H2O? What do we call H2O? Water. And so when people first started studying sugars or carbohydrates, another name for a carbohydrate is a saccharide, they measured for every carbon there is an H2O or a water. What's H2O? Water. So that's why they came up with this name, carbohydrate, because carbohydrate really means carbon hydrate. And when you hydrate something, what do? You just pour water on it, right? So a carbohydrate is just a carbon with a water molecule stuck on every carbon. So if you look at this, right, the formula is for every carbon, H2O, hence the name carbohydrate. Right, this compound can form a ring. This end of the molecule can join this one up over here to form this ring structure, right? And instead of drawing all this stuff out here, we just kind of symbolize it with this little oxygen right here forming this nice ring. So this is an example of a simple sugar, and the example here is glucose. There are other kinds of simple sugars. Okay. For instance, we might take two glucose molecules, two simple sugars, and join them together. Guess what we would call that molecule? That's a disaccharide. So this is a monosaccharide made of one glucose. Here's a disaccharide that's made of two. Or maybe we can take thousands of these monosaccharides and put them together to make one big, huge molecule. And that's what we call a polysaccharide. Otherwise, we could call that a polymer, with the basic building block just being glucose. Okay, let me see what the next slide looks like. Okay. So this molecule right here, this polysaccharide, could be given a different name. The two different names for this compound could be starch, or it could be called glycogen. Okay, what kind of food has a lot of starch in it? Potatoes, rice, wheat, like bread, anything that's made out of wheat flour. What else is made out of flour besides bread? Pasta, tortillas, all that stuff. So when you eat starch in that form, bread or tortillas or whatever, what is it that you're really eating? You're really eating a polysaccharide. And what's the basic building block of that polysaccharide? It is the monosaccharide, which is glucose. So when you eat bread, it's like eating sugar. It's really pure sugar, but it's all put together. Okay? So that's why I want you to know that for a polysaccharide, the building block is a monosaccharide. A good example of that would be glucose. And so when you eat starch, your body breaks it down into its building blocks. Okay? And then you absorb that into your blood. What happens to your blood glucose if you eat bread? It goes up, right? Yeah, or tortilla or whatever. Just like if you were to eat a sugar cube, same thing, right? Or a potato for that matter, right? Because that basic building block is glucose. Okay, so what do I have on this slide right here? Monosaccharide, disaccharide, glucose, glucose, polysaccharide, when you have many of these together. Okay, so I think when we start next time, right, we're going to go to lipids. And there are basic building blocks of lipids that your body uses to put together to make more complex lipids, just like your body made more complex polysaccharides or carbohydrates. Okay. These pictures right here?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't have these on Blackboard for you.
You don't have that?
I have, well, for instance, at the end of the lecture, I have pictures. Right here. Here's the atom. For you to practice labeling, because I might take that picture and put it on a test. So your question is, how do I get color on them?
No. I thought you had it on Blackboard.
Yeah, I do. This one is on Blackboard. I had chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 3 with pictures. I have to update. Yeah, I get them right from the book.
Do you have the paper notes that I need to get, or is that part of the packet that I have to buy, purchase, or? I know they're written notes, but
Oh, yeah, they're on Blackboard.
Okay.
So I have them on Blackboard, and let me show you how to get onto Blackboard.
Okay.
I don't have.
I know I'm trying to write everything.
That's
on
too much to write down.
Oh yeah. I was like, wait, you going to?
Let me tell you what. Let me turn my recorder off.